Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Now let's maybe just get a little bit of understanding about the role of the WTO is James Wise. He is the Senior Vice President at Height Consulting, and he is an expert on global trade matters. James Wise, thanks very much for being with us. Well, as the President just described the relationship between the United States and the World Trade Organization, maybe you could just offer us a little detail about what role the WTO plays, and do you believe what the President has described as a terrible relationship?
Sure. I mean, and thanks for having me on. I mean, the World Trade Organization, you know, is the rules-based system for about 95% of world trade. So it is critically important for fostering continued economic growth around the world. The president's comments are today, I think, are a continuation of what he's been saying all along, is he thinks American workers are getting a bad deal. And, you know, they're going to look at ways to undo the WTO's power. And you look at the bill that was sort of leaked out today. It's just another example of how Trump is looking broadly at how to weaken the WTO.
Well, based on your experience, I mean, I believe you worked for Senator John Tester of Montana. You were chief of staff,
right,
legislative director. You must have looked at this issue. Do you believe the United States is being treated unfairly by the World Trade Organization?
I think that there are certainly winners and losers in any trade environment. And I think what you're seeing is, you know, I've heard in recent weeks from, for example, a D.C. representative of one of the big unions saying, you know, his guys have thought they've been in a trade war for years. And now, just now, we're finally having somebody talk about how the United States is being victimized in the trade war. On the other hand, you know, as you pointed out, I worked for a pretty rural state for a long time, and agriculture depends on U.S. agriculture depends on really, really strong open markets. And so you have a situation where I think you've had some frustrating experiences on the manufacturing side, but to give those up for, you know, agriculture interests, as we're seeing, is it's going to be hard. And I think it's really a challenge for the government, whether you're the president or whether you're a member of Congress who represents a state or a district that is heavily dependent on trade, to balance the issue of winners and losers versus the fact that there is a perception, I think, out there among a lot of workers that the benefits of global trade have not been evenly and fairly distributed in the United States.
Mr. Wise, maybe you can help me out with something here. I'm a little confused because I'm old enough, and perhaps you are old enough to remember violent demonstrations against the WTO a few years back, both on this continent and overseas, and it was from a leftist perspective. And now you have really the Democrats in Congress who are defending the WTO and the Republicans who are more or less the party of free trade actually coalescing behind the president's protectionism, or it could be construed as protectionism. What's going on? Do I need a scorecard to keep track of this?
It certainly feels that way. I mean, the politics of trade right now are really, really interesting. I mean, obviously, as you say, Republicans historically have been the party of free trade and low tariffs. And then along comes Trump and essentially turns the party's position on its head overnight. And you know, Democrats have long been skeptical of free trade. But, you know, with Trump claiming that ground, as you point out, some Democrats are moving more towards free trade and sort of stressing the importance of economic connectivity with the rest of the world. And I think what we're going to see here over the next few months, as you know, the sort of small-scale trade wars that we've been seeing with Canada and with China start to heat up a little bit, I think you're really going to see some big decisions have to be made by both parties as they look towards November and to figure out how do we sustain this position, or can we?
I also thought the other thing that I always thought was the Earth is, you know, the world is getting smaller, and we are more interconnected than we've ever been. What is going to break this impasse? What in your mind needs to be done in order to get to a place where global trade is accepted?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's certainly something that if I were thinking about running for president in 2020 as a Democrat, I would really be thinking hard on right now, because we cannot afford to withdraw from the world. But by the same token, we still have this perception problem that, if the benefits of trade are not being felt across the entirety of the economy, then what's the point? And should we be, you know, taking more of a Trump position? And I think a lot of congressional Republicans are also dealing with this right now, really thinking hard about both what they've historically believed in and also the sort of populism that the president has really tapped into. And obviously we've seen in other elections this year, you know, the cost for Republicans in their primaries of going against the president can be pretty high, as we saw in South Carolina with Mark Sanford and some other folks this year.
Thanks very much for being with us. James Wise is the Senior Vice President for Height Consulting Group in Washington. You can follow them online at Height LLC, talking about the potential for the U.S. to withdraw from the World Trade Organization. Well, life in the fast lane for Tesla. Yes, we're not going to forget Tesla and their churning out of 5,031 Model 3 sedans. And whether this is really a turning point for the company or whether this is more of a publicity point for the company. Joining us, Gordon Johnson, analyst at the Vertical Group, and Kevin Tynan, Bloomberg Intelligence senior auto analyst. All right, Gordon Johnson, do it short and sweet for us. Give us your bear case for why investors ought to stay away from Tesla.
Right. So they said this is a factory gate number, which means it's cars out of the factory, which is not completed cars. If you look at over the first 84 days of the second quarter, on average, they produced just 1,960 cars. That's far less than what Elon Musk said they would do in April, of 3,000 to 4,000 cars. And we think there's going to be significant cash burn. They built about $500 million of Model 3 inventory in Q2. And we think there's going to be further cash burn in Q3 and 4. So for those reasons, you know, we're bearish on the stock.
Kevin, what is your thoughts? Response to Gordon?
Yeah, and I would agree with everything Gordon said. And I think that, you know, fundamentally for me, you know, and I think this is the issue with most analysts, at least the bearish ones, are, you know, even going back to battery electric consumer demand, you know, just sort of questioning if it is this disruptor that everybody sees just based on pricing, recharge time, the infrastructure. So I wonder, you know, just even in at the base level, is the addressable market as large as everybody sees? And then when you roll through what that means for the demand levels, not being able to get to production, you get through the financial statements of Tesla and you say, okay, even if they can do all these things, now you're going to assign a ridiculous multiple to ultimately what is an automaker, and it's very difficult to reconcile all those things back to where you see the market cap of this company.
I'm a little disappointed, Kevin, because I thought maybe you and Gordon could wrestle this out, but if you're agreeing... but anyway, Gordon, one of the things that I think I read in this and all this foo-fara that's come out about Tesla today is that they don't
foo-fara?
Foo-fara. Yeah, a lot of hullabaloo and stuff like that. The no capital raise this year, Gordon, is this isn't that good news?
Well, no, I don't think it's good news. I think that, you know, they've essentially sent out requests to all of their, essentially Model 3 reservation holders to configure. And that's another way of them generating cash, but it's not really cash it's not really their cash, right? If you have somebody's deposit and they haven't effectively configured that deposit and purchased that car, it's not your cash, but that's cash that Tesla has. I think the other key dynamic here, which I haven't seen really get any press, is their net reservation number. Their net reservation number dropped to 420,000 cars. We spoke to management at Tesla about a week ago, and they told us they haven't had any new reservations of Model 3s for roughly a year. That's from them. But this number confirms that quote, i.e., they've had 455 net reservations since basically August of 2017, and now that number drops to 420. So that means that either you've had cancellations of 30,000 or you've had deliveries of roughly 30,000. You haven't had new reservations to come in to take over that. So it looks like demand could be a problem for them. And instead of being supply constrained, as we enter next year, they may be demand constrained. I think that's something nobody's considering. Also, last thing, Model S and X sales combined, year-to-date 2018 down 6% versus 2017. Last year, that number was up 61%. That's also something we don't think people are focused on, cannibalization of Model S sales via Model 3 sales.
Kevin, it sounds like from what Gordon has been saying that it used to be cool to wait for a Tesla, but patience is up. Is that your analysis as well?
Yeah, and you know, one thing, Bob, I looked at, and I went back a bunch of years and started in 2013, and I looked at three drivetrain technologies, right? The gasoline hybrids, the plug-in electrics, and then the battery electrics. And I looked at them as a group, and I took those numbers forward from 2013 through 2017. And when you look at that, those three technologies together, actually unit sales were down something like 4%. So it makes me think that this group of sort of first adopters or technology buyers of these alternative drivetrains are really the same size group. And over the years, all they've done is moved up as the technology has advanced, not necessarily pulling in new buyers to the group. And I think that goes to Gordon's point about these reservation holders. And it makes me wonder, you know, are there... It's one thing to have, let's say, 400,000 reservations for Model 3, but are you getting those every single year? Are you growing that base every single year? And I think a lot of that comes down to the idea of this elusive $35,000 Model 3. If you can't get average transaction prices in that range, then I don't think you ever get that kind of consistent year-over-year demand for this technology.
Kevin, do you believe that in 10 years, majority of people will be driving electric-powered vehicles?
I hesitate. I don't think so. And again, this, you know, China could be a big part of this, of amortizing the cost of the technology and bringing it down and making it more affordable. But if you look at the average transaction price in the U.S. of every vehicle, it's roughly around $35,000. And I think you have to be at that or below it and be profitable to even talk about half the market being battery electric.
Thanks very much, gentlemen. Very interesting. Gordon Johnson of Vertical Research Group and also Kevin Tynan, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Auto Analyst.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
It up. Jessica Summers, she's an oil trading reporter with Bloomberg News, and Jessica is going to answer the big question for me for this week when a lot of Americans are traveling for the holiday. Are we going to have higher gas prices?
It's looking rough. So essentially, you know, we're really definitely seeing consumers hurting at the pump here and into the holiday weekend. Although crude prices are dropping today, you know, they're still trading in the 70s. Which is a very high level. It trickles down to the retail level, and that really puts pressure on retail prices. So right now we're seeing U.S. retail gasoline average at about $2.86 a gallon. That's very close to $3, and that would be the highest since 2014.
Because I was traveling this weekend, and we have in New Jersey about $2.74, but you cross the border into a different state, and it's like $3.20. It's pretty bad. Do you remember? It wasn't that long ago. We had $1.50 a gallon gas.
That's no more the case. So, one other point to add is, you know, these higher prices don't seem to be stopping anyone from actually planning a July 4th road trip. AAA has come out and said that about 39.7 million travelers will hit the road for July 4th.
Well, let me just offer a little international perspective, even though I know you're just going to be driving in the United States or maybe even North America. But, you know, let's say that we go to $3 a gallon, okay, right? That's 15 cents above the national average
right
now. I think we're
already,
already
there in a lot of places.
Just about, you know, Mexico, more expensive. China, India, South Africa, Japan. The list goes on.
I don't think I'm driving to Japan this
weekend. I understand that. But, I mean, Japan is still... recognized as the third largest economy in the world. They're paying nearly $5 a gallon. China's paying $4.50 a gallon. Most of Europe is paying over $6.50 a gallon. And they still manage to go ahead.
To paraphrase the BBC, low petrol prices are a God-given right for Americans.
Well, my point is that when you factor in inflation over the course of many years, gasoline prices are pretty inexpensive compared to what the rest of the world has had to pay.
And just as Jessica just said, AAA is saying that nobody's changing their plans this. They haven't gone up that much.
Travel's actually going to be up 5.1% more than last year.
So people really are taken to the roads as a result. So, all right, a question to you, though, is this whole idea of whether the Saudis are going to pump more oil in order to make up for shortfalls in maybe production from Venezuela, is that likely to have any effect? I mean, they said, what, about 1 million barrels a day more? That was what they were going to pump?
So, yeah, so what's interesting is that, you know, OPEC and allies such as Russia have come out and agreed to the 1 million barrel a day increase in output. So now we have President Trump, you know, talking to the king and saying that he wants Saudi Arabia to pump 2 million barrels a day. So, you know, if we do see them reach, you know, their maximum capacity, let's say, and that's at about, you know, 12 million barrels a day, that could really push the price of oil down further.
Is there any likelihood that that's going to happen? I mean, is that in their interest to do so? Because isn't it sort of a conflict that's been going on between Saudi Arabia and Iran in terms of how much oil OPEC would pump?
Absolutely. You know, after this deal has been announced, we actually had the Iranian oil minister coming out recently and saying, look, you know, any production increase above the limits that were agreed upon would breach the deal. You know, he also said that OPEC should reject the U.S. call for a production increase, which is, quote, politically motivated against Iran. So, you know, this call on Saudi Arabia to really ramp up output is creating a lot of rifts and tensions between some of the world's largest crude producers.
Now, just, you know, in the recent history, what was it, about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, OPEC was on the verge of collapsing. Mm-hmm. And then this last meeting that we had, however, it seemed like they were all getting along like old chums. Now, all of a sudden, between meetings, we have this pressure from the U.S. president. And is it really the pressure from Trump that's really creating this rift?
Well, one more interesting thing to point out to you, and this is something that investors have been talking to me about, and it's what's causing the market, you know, to have a little bit of nervousness in it. Is that, you know, if Saudi Arabia does in fact listen to Trump, and if, you know, they do pump at their maximum output levels, they might run out of spare capacity. So that's something that worries investors, because right now we're looking at global supply risks and issues in places like Libya and Canada and Venezuela. So if Saudi Arabia is not going to have that spare capacity, that could be a real problem. And the other thing investors are telling me is that, you know, Saudi, if they do decide to ramp up and listen to Trump and do this quickly, it could actually harm their own oil fields. And, you know, by trying to turn the taps up too fast, that could be a huge problem.
And also, isn't it worth noting that the amount of U.S. oil imports has been dropping like every year since something like 2006?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that the figures are like we've cut almost 10 million barrels per day of imports, while at the same time we've increased production to the point where I think most of it's coming from the Permian Basin in West Texas.
Absolutely, hitting record levels of productions. We're hitting record levels of U.S. crude exports. There's been a real demand for U.S. crude globally lately, and that's because some of these supply risks that I've mentioned, these supply outages in places all over the world have sort of hit at the same time, and that's why we are seeing these record U.S. crude export levels.
We still, though, we haven't achieved this mythical energy self-sufficiency, though, have we? Are we close to it? Are we going to get there, or we're still going to have to import?
You know, that really depends. One issue we are seeing in the U.S., you know, sort of our bottlenecks in the Permian Basin. And, you know, there's so much production, there's so much pumping going on, and, you know, there's just not enough, there's transportation and logistic constraints. So we're not seeing that oil being able to ship down to the Gulf Coast for export quick enough. And there's just not a lot of pipeline capacity that's spare.
Right, so it's our own bottlenecks. Jessica Summers, Bloomberg News, thanks so much for coming in and talking about oil.
Listen to this song. Get out of your own way.
Yes, he comes equipped with his own music. Bloomberg Stocks columnist Dave Wilson. And remember to send Dave an email at dwilson@bloomberg.net. Sign up for his daily free email newsletter and maybe even share one of your musical selections. And Dave, your chart of the day, I believe, has to do with interest rates and maybe not following interest rates as a guide to what stocks are going to do.
Right. You got to get out of your own way, as you two sang. And, of course, they were here in New York last week, Sunday night. Bruce Springsteen saw them. On Friday night, they were in New Jersey, and I saw them, so I had to play the song. In any case, this is all about sort of the scenario going into the start of the year. And stop me if you've heard this one before, because I find myself talking about it day to day, looking at markets. Is that you were supposed to, because rates were going to rise, interest rates, the financial stocks were supposed to be the beneficiaries of that. So, you figure they move higher. And then all the rate-sensitive areas of the market, think about real estate, phone companies, utilities, they were not supposed to do so well. Well, you could argue the rate-sensitive stocks kind of held up their end of that bargain, because if you sort of combine the three groups into an index, weight them equally, which you can do on the Bloomberg terminal, so I did it for the chart, you find out that overall they fell a little bit more than 3% in the first half. Trouble is, the financial companies did not perform as, sort of the prevailing view might have suggested. Rather than rising, they hit their peak back in January, when the S&P 500 more broadly did. And they struggled for a good part of the first half to sustain any gains at all. And last month, you had a 13-session losing streak for the S&P 500 Financials Index. So it ended with a loss of 4.9%. Yeah, the financial stocks did worse than the rate-sensitive shares, even though you had the Federal Reserve lifting its benchmark rate twice. You had the 10-year Treasury yield going up about half a percentage point. Now, you can argue why it is that what was happening in the market was, the gaps between, say, money market rates and bond yields were getting narrower, not wider, and that meant the financial companies would have a harder time making money. But what you can't deny is that things just didn't work out the way many people were anticipating when the year began. If you want to know more, folks, send me an email. I'll get you the chart, the explanation that goes with it, and everything I do going forward. The email address is dwilson@bloomberg.net. That's dwilson@bloomberg.net.
Thank you very much, Dave Wilson, Bloomberg Stocks columnist.
In the Bloomberg studio, just mere meter away from me, is Hema Parmar. She's the consumer retail reporter for Bloomberg News. And she's got this, I think one of the biggest surprises of the stock market this year is Macy's. It's up about, what I got there,
44.5%
since the first of the year. And Hema's got a reason why it's doing so well.
Mm-hmm. So Macy's, a couple of years ago, bought this cosmetics company called Blue Mercury. And it's, a competitor to, say, Sephora or Ulta. They do cosmetics and sort of spa services as well. And so what Macy's is doing now is they're planning to open up 60 new standalone stores of Blue Mercury, about 30 this year, about 30 next year. And they'll also open some additional stores inside of existing Macy's buildings. So as part of their big push of the brand, they've opened up about 100 stores in the past 3 years alone. So it's been a pretty steady and pretty brisk pace of opening up a lot of these cosmetic stores.
Well, hasn't the push of retail really been online? And here mm-hmm. Macy's is, figuratively, I guess, mm-hmm. building bricks and mortar. And how are they going to incorporate? Are they going to incorporate new technology?
And just
at
to
all,
let you know, this is actually a reverse, because they started as an online shopping website.
Blue Mercury did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yep. So they really got into the online shopping before it became as big of a craze as it is now. And so they are adept in both the online shopping purchases and, to your point, the brick and mortar, given a lot of struggles that we've seen with brick and mortar and retail and kind of the death of like these sort of big institutional malls. But the reason that, how this fits into Macy's sort of broader strategy is it's trying to defend the rise of some of the competitors like Sephora. It's trying to keep up with online buying and online demand from consumers. And earlier this year, the outgoing CFO of Macy's had said that its beauty division needed to be rethought. And so this push kind of jives with this move to make some progress. And they say, Macy's said in their earnings, that cosmetic sales gained traction in the fourth quarter first quarter of this year and helped their revenue beat estimates. So, you know, it is part of their real big push, and they have been talking about expanding this chain since they took it on. What's interesting is, you know, since Blue Mercury kind of came about, they were focusing on these big cities, these coastal cities, and what they're doing now is really targeting smaller towns and cities like Raleigh, North Carolina, and other smaller spaces.
We're making Chattanooga more beautiful, is what we're doing here.
Everything more beautiful. Thank you very much. Hema Parmar, Bloomberg News reporter, covering the world of Macy's and now Blue Mercury, of course. They bought Blue Mercury, I think it was 2015 for like $210 million.
And you've been shopping there ever since, haven't you?
Thank you.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
We have less than 10 minutes to the close on the first day of the second half of 2018. And to help us drive there is Mark Esposito. He's the CEO of Esposito Securities in Dallas. Welcome, Mark.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The one big question for me is, and I'm sure Pim's got more sophisticated questions, but last year, 19% increase in the S&P 500. This year, so far, less than 2%. What's going on?
Well, I think that these trade tariffs have really tempered that marketplace. I think the real big upside this year so far has been in the composite and the technology sector. You know, AI, robotics, and technology are really hot. I do think, you know, I'm still bullish on the market. We've got corporate buybacks at the highest level ever. Institutions are usually right, and last month we saw retail peel out of a lot of $20 billion plus in equity assets, and they're usually wrong.
Mark, I'm wondering if you could just give us your perspective right now on where you would put new money to work in the market.
Yeah, I think to stay away from trade short-term concerns, which I don't think are really long-term concerns, you know, it's best to buy service stocks like FANG stocks and to buy stocks here in the U.S. that don't operate overseas operations. There's many of those that can be bought and that are reasonably priced.
You say that that's a short-term play, but what about this nonsense with the WTO? Does that make you pause does that make you scary a little bit or what?
Yeah, I think, you know, the stimulus package here in the U.S. is working. I mean, we're going to see, you know, continued upside to corporate earnings. I think cooler heads will prevail in the trade talks. I think that, you know, when you look at U.S.-China, if you add in U.S. subsidiaries, then you look and see that there's a zero-sum game. The trade deficit is zero if you add in U.S. subsidiaries. And so we're fighting over nothing. There may be one lopsided company here or a couple lopsided companies there, but at the end of the day, net-net, it's all flat between the two largest economies. And I think, you know, Mr. Trump has an agenda. I think it's correct, and I think he's doing the right thing, which has made the markets a little bit more volatile. But I think at the end of the day, you know, we'll see. That's not going to be the biggest news of the year. I think stimulus and what the Fed does will really govern that.
Mark, just to return to some of the stocks that you were thinking of, Facebook, for example, up 11.5% so far this year. You still a buyer at nearly $200 a share? It's right now $196. It's up $2.50.
Yeah, I think, you know, in this trade war environment, those stocks will do better than most. I think some that are under pressure from the trade wars are not going to fare so well in the short term. But like I said, we still see in the short term that we're in a bull market.
Okay, but when do you sell? I mean, if you're a holder of Netflix, you've got a gain of more than 106% this year. When do you sell some of your holdings?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, if you're up 100%, you got a tax problem on your hand. And so yeah, what do you do? I think most people would opt to say, it's still a great company, it's going to grow, I'll keep it, I don't want to pay tax on double my money.
So hold on to the shares.
Yeah, that's what I would do if it was my stock.
Is there anything you'd stay away from? You were talking about how the short-term trade stuff might weigh heavily on some stocks.
Yeah, there's been some stocks that have been highly affected, like Harley-Davidson, who, you know, may have to go offshore to produce some of their motorcycles. I think there's a whole realm of those stocks that, you know, you may just in the short term want to stay away from, and then they'll become buys again, I think, when the trade talks simmer down and the political powers go back to work governing their countries.
Amazon. What about Amazon.com? Stock up 46% so far this year. Is Amazon a stock you want to own at the $1,700 a share?
Yeah, it's hard, you know, to buy stocks that are up 46%. But if you look at the future of the world and our economy, I mean, technology, AI, and supply chain is where everything's growing. And so, you know, the composite's up 11% this year. That's for a reason. The future is AI and technology and robotics in our country, and Amazon hits all those themes in some way, shape, or form. Can it grow at 46% forever? No, no company can, but I don't really choose valuations, but I would say that I would love to be in the technology, robotics, and AI space. That's a great space to be in.
Do you feel the same way about the energy sector right now?
Well, I do, and here's why I feel strongly about energy. You know, I've been saying for a few months that oil can hit 100. I still see that being the case because I do believe, and even Mr. Trump over the weekend tweeted that he believes more supply is needed, that we're in an undersupply situation. And with oil, you just don't on Monday, you know, say I want more production on Tuesday, you get it. It takes months. Could even take longer for that supply to come online. Now, at $75 a barrel, people can make money on oil, but they got to get it to market, and it's not ready, and there's not enough. And so I think in the short term, you'll see, you know, oil especially go up.
Got it. Thanks very much. Mark Esposito, he is the chief executive of Esposito Securities, joining us from Dallas, Texas.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.